Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPD 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Douglas Caddy, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on your program. I'm honored to do so.
Ah, it's good to have you. Wow. So you've had quite the life. It's a way to start. Let's talk about you so people know who you are. How did you get into the legal business and come across some of the people like E. Howard Hunt and Liddy and stuff? So were you a practicing lawyer? Let's talk about back in the day and how you started.
Well, I cover this in my new autobiography that just came out. It's called Being There, Eyewitness to History. And I trace, I really actually start off in New Orleans, and which is relevant here, in New Orleans in the 1950s. In 1954-55, I was in high school in New Orleans, going to Alcee Fortier High School, and Joe McCarthy was up for being censured, and my parents suggested I go to a rally in Audubon Park, which was nearby, to support Joe McCarthy. They were very big fans of Joe McCarthy.
Okay.
I was just in high school. But I went there, and they asked me to set up a card table in the French Quarter opposite St. Louis Cathedral, and which I did, and I got signatures for Joe McCarthy because the people going in and out of the cathedral were Catholic, and so was Joe McCarthy. But as a result of that, the organizer of that rally, Ken Courtney, asked me to go to a meeting with Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister was the assistant police superintendent of New Orleans at that time. This was 1954-55. And the discussion was Aaron Cohen Crime Commission. But and I worked with Guy Bannister on that off and on, even though I was in high school. And at that time, Lee Harvey Oswald was going to high school in New Orleans. He was living on Exchange Place in New Orleans, and a 5-minute walk from Guy Bannister. And as you know, the Kennedy assassination, Guy Bannister was the handler of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963, when Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans, and the months just preceding his going to Dallas, where he became the alleged assassin. And I later became legal counsel to Howard Hunt in Watergate. But this was 1955, and none of us knew in 1955, we were within walking distance of each other, Lee Harvey Oswald, Guy Bannister, myself, that 8 years later, all of us would one way or another be connected with the Kennedy assassination. And this sort of leads into Watergate too, because I'll jump ahead and just disclose here at the beginning that the burglars who went into Watergate were team number one in the Kennedy assassination. They were the same people involved in both crimes. And as much as the Watergate break-in was investigated by the Senate Watergate Committee and the Watergate Special Counsel Prosecutor, it never came out in those years that it was the same people involved in both crimes. And I had gone to law school at New York University in the 1960s. When I was graduated from law school, New York University Law School, I went to work for General Foods Corporation in White Plains, New York. General Foods at that time was the world's largest food manufacturer, Post cereals, Maxwell House coffee, and all sorts of things you would even recognize today. And they sent me to Washington after 2 years to be their Washington representative. But they said they wanted me to work out of the Mullen Company, which was their public relations firm. And so in 1969, I was transferred from White Plains to Washington. And 6 months after I started working out of the Mullen Company, I was a General Foods employee, but I was working out of the Mullen Company for the first year until General Foods wanted to set up its own separate office. Howard Hunt showed up on the scene. He'd been placed there by Richard Helms, the director of the CIA. And he was allegedly entering retirement, but I don't know whether these CIA agents ever retire formally. And so we started talking, and it turned out that the godfather to several of Howard Hunt's children was William F. Buckley, and I'd written for William F. Buckley's magazine when I was at Georgetown undergraduate, and knew him well, and so we bonded. And then I left General Foods employee about 1971, early 71, and went into law practice, and Howard Hunt was actually my first client at Ordinary Legal Matters. But when Watergate broke on June 17th, early mornings of June 17th, 1972, which is when the Watergate burglars were arrested, Howard Hunt called me from his office in the White House and said, could he come over? He had an important matter to discuss. And I said, come on over. I lived about a mile from the White House in Washington, and as it turned out, about a mile from the Watergate complex. And so Howard Hunt came over. This would be about just after 3 a.m. in the morning, and he told me what had occurred. Came as a complete shock to me, and I realized the significance of it. He told me that the arrest of the five burglars at Watergate and how he and Gordon Liddy had escaped because they were actually in the hotel that adjoins the Watergate office building where the Democratic National Committee had its offices and where the burglars were arrested. And so that's how I got involved in Watergate.
So
Howard Hunt.
Yeah, so you're saying that same team with E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. So were they involved in the Kennedy assassination as well?
Well, Howard Hunt admits on, you can listen to his confession, his deathbed confession on the internet that he gave to his son, St. John Hunt, before he died, in which he discloses that he was approached. He says he was a bench warmer, but my information is he was much warmer than a bench warmer in the assassination, and allegedly he was the spotter for Frank Sturgis, who was one of the burglars and who was one of the shooters from the grassy knoll of the assassination. And if you read Howard Hunt's autobiographies, he was very anti-Kennedy, anti-JFK, because he blamed the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion in June of 1961 on Kennedy's last minute, in the middle of the invasion is when Kennedy decided to call it off. And he had his own valid reasons for doing so, but the Cuban Americans never forgave him for doing that, nor did the CIA. And he as a result of that, JFK fired Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, because he thought that he had been only inaugurated in January. He felt that he had been trapped into a much more complicated military operation than he had been briefed about.
Now, how can you tie LBJ to E. Howard Hunt?
Well, in his deathbed confession, he lists about eight individuals that he says, most of whom are CIA agents that whom he knew intimately, has been involved in the Kennedy assassination. But he says in his deathbed confession, which, again, you can listen to on the Internet, that LBJ was at the top of the pyramid at that time. And, you know, LBJ was vice president then. And he maintains that the top of the conspiracy, top of the pyramid conspiracy to kill John Kennedy was LBJ. And strange enough, years later, when I left Washington and moved to Texas, I ultimately became legal counsel to Billy Saul Estes, who was one of the most famous crime figures in America, and who was LBJ's bagman and secret business partner. And LBJ died in the midst of the first Watergate trial in 1971. And in 1984, Billy Saul Estes asked me to represent him in getting immunity from the Justice Department so that he could tell what he knew about all the crimes that had been committed by LBJ. And as part of that, the Justice Department said they needed a letter of proffer indicating what he would disclose, and among those things that he disclosed was the role of LBJ in the assassination of John Kennedy. He claimed there were four people that made decisions on a number of people that had to be killed. It was LBJ and Cliff Carter, his administrative assistant, and Mack Wallace, who was the stone killer that LBJ kept on as an economist in the Department of Agriculture, essentially to do the bidding for the killing, and Billy Saul Estes. Billy Saul Estes said that he said that at the top of the pyramid in his own way, that the top of the pyramid was LBJ, and he was the bagman for LBJ and knew LBJ intimately for 25 years. And so neither Howard Hunt or Billy Saul Estes had ever had contact, but both of these famous figures targeted LBJ as being at the top of the pyramid of the assassination to kill Kennedy.
Well, being that he was part of that then in the same group that did the assassination, and most of that group as well, you're saying, was involved in Watergate. So was LBJ aware of Watergate or involved with it as well with the same group of people?
No, he was not. You know, Watergate was an operation. I have to indicate this. After I went to work for this law firm in Washington, and Howard Hunt was one of my clients, he asked me to write a letter of reference for him to join the staff of the White House. He'd been invited to join the staff of the White House by Cliff Colson, one of Nixon's closest aides, because they were both alumni of Brown University. But he needed for the file letters of reference, and I was glad to do so. And as it turned out, from we know from the history of Watergate, that it was really John Dean, who was counsel to the White House counsel, who made the decision to send the burglars in on June 17th. And Gord Liddy actually was a team leader, but underneath him were Howard Hunt and the four Cuban Americans, and also James McCord, who was a former high official, you might say, was a high official in the CIA.
Wow. So now, going back to Watergate, who were the people that were involved with Hunt and Liddy?
Well, you had the four Cuban Americans. We'll start off with the top of the team was Gord Liddy. And I have to disclose as part of as I do in my book, that I was working for this law firm in Washington, and in April, a partner of the law firm got a call from George Webster, the chairman of the Lawyers Committee for the reelection of the president, saying they needed a lawyer to be volunteered to work for the Lawyers Committee for the reelection of the president, and I was volunteered by my partner. So I called George Webster to get my assignment, and he said, report to John Dean, White House counsel. And I said, wow, I'm starting at the top. So I reported to John Dean, and he gave me these ordinary campaign assignments. And then later on, he said I should report to Gordon Liddy, who was legal counsel to the Finance Committee, which was separate from the Committee for the Re-election of the President, to the Finance Committee for the Re-election of the President. And so I did legal work for Gordon Liddy, really legal campaign research work is what it was. And so as it turned out that Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt, we do know from the history of Watergate, had done a number of things before on behalf of the White House, covert activities before Watergate occurred and before the arrest took place and before the scandal took place. And I did not know that, but they were intimately involved in all sorts of things. But the decision to go back in on June 17th was John Dean's decision. And as I say, Gordon Liddy was a team leader, and underneath him was Howard Hunt with the poor Cuban Americans, and then James McCord. The poor Cuban Americans and James McCord were arrested inside the offices of the Democratic National Committee. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy were in the hotel adjacent, and they escaped. The arresting officer was Carl Schaffler. He was a detective with the Washington, D.C. police, but actually he was on loan to them from military intelligence, from the Pentagon. And he had received inside information from a confidential informant named Robert Merritt, who learned of the break-in through his own resources. And so Carl Schaffler was sitting in an automobile just a block away from Watergate, waiting for the burglary to go down so that he could go in and arrest those individuals. Of course, the burglars were not aware that their plan had been blown, but it was essentially a setup by Carl Schaffler and by military intelligence to bring Nixon down, ultimately using Watergate to do so. And the CIA was also heavily involved in this. The reason the military intelligence and the CIA and the NSA and other law enforcement agencies wanted Nixon brought down was he had started the Houston plan, which was a plan he had started that 2 years previously to Watergate. And this fellow I mentioned, Robert Merritt, was the sole employee, and it was to compete with the FBI, with the CIA, with the NSA, and all these agencies, and to do things that they would not do. It would go much further on. And all these agencies were rather upset, to say the least, that Nixon had created the Houston plan and had it underway. John Dean was actually administering it from the White House. And so, they felt that their bureaucratic prerogatives had been, tread upon, justifiably so. And so, in my opinion, Nixon was set up through Watergate to be brought down because of his sponsoring of the Houston plan, which competed with the CIA and the FBI and these agencies.
So with your dealings with E. Howard Hunt, and you knew him personally in that, first of all, who was he, just for mainly for the young listeners, as well as what did you think of him as a person?
Well, Howard Hunt, during World War II, was he started out with the OSS, but his assignment was with Life magazine. That was his cover, and he covered the Pacific Theater. He covered General MacArthur personally, but his main client, you might say, was General MacArthur. That was what Life magazine was interested in. And after World War II ended, and Truman created the CIA under the National Security Act in 1947. Howard Hunt left the OSS and went into the CIA. He was one of the original employees of the CIA. And he became known by all the original founders of the CIA. And that's why Richard Helms, who was the director of the CIA, placed him in the Mellon Company. He was on first-name basis with all these individuals. And he had done a number of things for the CIA as a career agent. Among them, much of the activity took place in Latin America, fighting the inroads of communism in Latin and South America. And he has quite a history And Nixon alludes to this in the Oval Office tapes because he says underneath that scab of Howard Hunt is a lot to be told. He didn't go any further in the Oval Office tapes to say what could be told, but he did indicate that Howard Hunt was the keeper of many, many secrets. And so his whole history had really been, he was a graduate of Brown University, his whole history had really been in covert activities for our intelligence agencies. Ultimately, he and Gordon Liddy they went to prison for what occurred in Watergate. Howard Hunt's wife, Dorothy, was the break-in took place in June 1972, and Howard Hunt's wife, Dorothy, was killed in a plane crash in December of 1972, a month before the first Watergate trial. And I'm one of those who believe that it was a commercial plane that went down at the Midway Airport in Chicago in December of 1972. But I believe it was not a natural death. And I encourage those listening to this program to listen to an interview between Howard Hunt and Chuck Colson, his sponsor in the White House. You can listen to it on the internet. Just put in Howard Hunt's telephone conversation with Chuck Colson, which took place in November of 1972, 2 weeks after the election, in which Howard Hunt said to Chuck Colson, "Everybody's going to go to prison, and we want our hush money. We want our families taken care of. And if this money, hush money, and is not forthcoming, well, the whole world will know what took place." You know, he made an overt threat, and you can listen to it to Chuck Colson. To blow the whistle on what Watergate was all about, and I think and I believe the payoff, what happened as a result of that was Dorothy being killed the next month, and Howard Hunt did call his four children together right afterwards and said, "I'm going to plead guilty at the upcoming trial in January, because if I don't, I'm afraid you're going to be killed next." And so he did plead guilty in January of 1973. In Watergate, and the four Cuban Americans followed him. That just left James McCord and Gordon Liddy to stand trial. And I did testify at that trial. I testified as a witness for the prosecution involuntarily and as a voluntary witness for the two defendants.
So what did you think of Howard Hunt as a person?
Well, if he were here talking on the phone right now, you would be charmed by him, because he was a wonderful conversationalist. He was from the old school. His manners and courtesy were just fabulous, you might say. I mean, he couldn't be more courteous to people, and his conversation showed that. And he was a true gentleman. But beneath that was all the things that he had done. In other words, Howard Hunt and Dorothy were my two closest friends in Washington in the years leading up to Watergate. But at no time did he ever give me any indication that he had been involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. He being a professional, kept this to his breast, and kept many of his secrets to his breast, though we did have some conversations about things. Almost any conversation I had with Howard Hunt eventually came back to the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, which took place in June of 1961, 6 months, 5 to 6 months after JFK was inaugurated. It had actually been set up under Eisenhower and Nixon as vice president. He inherited it from them, and it just went awry for a number of reasons. But Howard Hunt was an extremely bright and dedicated patriot. And he probably did a number of things for our country that probably would never be disclosed, because the CIA would never disclose those.
So are you pro CIA? Do you believe the CIA is out there to protect Americans, protect the way of life, and to do good? Or do you think that there's something more sinister about the operation?
Well, I think overall it does good and wants to do good, but there's a large rogue element in it. It's always been in. I'm talking about large, extremely large, maybe approaching 40%, with 60% being good. And it's the rogue element that we have to worry about that is involved in all sorts of things, including the Kennedy assassination, including bringing Nixon down, and including the mass killings of peasants and poor people in these Latin American countries, so that corporations such as United Fruit Company and General Foods and so forth could have their plantations down there to reap their crops and get their money from their crops in selling their products. And so it's a very complicated organization. I will disclose that for the last several years I've been working with James Rothstein, a retired NYPD detective, and he was a very famous detective in the New York Police Department. And one of the things he discovered was a safe house. There were actually three safe houses operated in the 1960s, and maybe even operated today for all we know, we call them safe houses, but they're really houses where the CIA brought targets, people they wanted to compromise, and they would have them engage in.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sexual activity voluntarily, and then record this, and they use it as blackmail to control these people. And one of these three small children were killed. And James Rothstein and his partner uncovered this. But the children were buried on a farm in Connecticut. My point being, this was the evil side of the CIA, because those children did not have to be killed as part of that sexual activity, but the target was apparently so important that they went and did so. So there's all sorts of things that take place in the CIA that we have very little knowledge of. The CIA was very upset, in my opinion, with the fall of Batista when Castro took over, had the revolution in Cuba, because the casinos that were run in Havana at the time was where the CIA laundered its drug money from around the world, and they lost that when Castro took power, because Castro shut down all the casinos and shut down the prostitution rings too. He said, "I don't want our women to be prostitutes like they have been under the CIA and under the previous Cuban regime." Batista's regime. So CIA was definitely involved, heavily involved in the Kennedy assassination. But once again, we just know that they do wonderful things too. It's such a complicated organization, and I do fault them that they are still withholding thousands of documents on the Kennedy assassination that they should disclose, but they're still withholding those, and until those are disclosed, we'll never know what information is being withheld.
So do you think the CIA, in the rogue part of it, the 40%, who runs that? Is there someone within that internal group that is in charge that makes these plans, or is there a group of people that do this, or does it just sort of work as an entity and go where it will?
Well, I don't know at the present time, but at the time of Watergate, the Kennedy assassination, let's focus on the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
It was Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was the director of the CIA. He was fired by Kennedy as a result of a debacle with the Bay of Pigs. And James Angleton continued on with the CIA. But these were two powerful people who were leaders of the rogue element, even though Alan Dulles was a director of the CIA. And I'm of the opinion, I have a minority opinion on the Kennedy assassination, which only a few people believe in, one of them being Jim Mars, and the other being Linda Moulton-Howe and myself, and we believe that there is a government above the government. At the time of the Kennedy assassination, Alan Dulles was head of it, but this is an organization that was founded at the time of the when Truman founded the CIA. He created Majestic 12, which was composed of 12 prominent academic and military people to study the possibility that the Earth was being visited by aliens from outer space, from another dimension, or UFOs, or whatever you want to call it. JFK was well aware of this. He had been briefed very thoroughly about this, and he was killed. And Howard Hunt told me he was killed. I had dinner with Howard Hunt just before Howard Hunt went into prison in 1975 for Watergate. We had dinner. I had only seen him the night that of the break-in when he came to my apartment. I had only seen him at Dorothy's funeral, and then I saw him at that dinner in 1971 because I had been pulled before the grand jury early on investigating Watergate. I could no longer have conversations with him, or I could, but they would have to be disclosed, perhaps. But outside of the restaurant in Yenshin Palace in Washington, I asked Howard Hunt why Kennedy had been assassinated, and he said Kennedy was in the process of giving our most vital secret to the Soviets, and I was stunned by that, and I said, what was that? And he said, the alien presence. And with that, he shook my hand and walked away. And Kennedy actually was engaged at that time to work to build bridges with Khrushchev. He wanted to he proposed at a speech before the United Nations that outer space, that landing on the moon and outer space be explored in a joint mission between the Soviet Union and the United States. And he was building other bridges with Khrushchev too. And this scared I call it not the deep state, I call this the dark state. This scared the dark state, which is really above the deep state, and that's why they had to get rid of John Kennedy. He was about to give our most vital secret to the Russians. And also at the time when Kennedy was president, as you remember, this was a time when the Pentagon was giving, through Colonel Philip Corso, was giving materials that had been recovered from these UFO crashes and actually been given us by certain elements of the alien presence, giving these to corporations to back engineer. Many of the marvels that we enjoy today came from that. And this was another thing that the deep state was scared of. They were scared that Kennedy would give these same materials to this to the Soviet Union and let them back engineer it too.
What was the reasoning behind Kennedy giving Khrushchev and the Russians the information? Like explain that in the sense that so I can understand. I'm just trying to figure out that why Kennedy was doing that.
Well, you know, in Bay of Pigs was 1961. Then we had the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, which nearly led to the first nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States.
Right.
But out of that came building the bridges, personal bridges between JFK and Khrushchev. And the feeling, as I understand it, the belief on Kennedy's part was it was time to build a bridge and see if there were not things we would have in common that we could engage in common with the Soviet Union. And also he felt that in order to deal with the alien presence, such as it was, or such as it is, we needed the cooperation of the second most powerful country in the world at that time, which is the Soviet Union. And that was his motivation. And, he made certain steps in the months before he was killed to indicate that was what he was trying to do. And this scared the deep state, and they had to get rid of him, which they did. And with LBJ, they had a trusted vice president.
Now, I wanted to step back for a minute. You mentioned Dorothy Hunt.
Yes.
And the plane crash. How is it that they killed her when she was on the plane that crashed? Like, can you detail that a little bit more?
Well, the plane allegedly crashed through pilot error at Midway Airport. But it was a commercial plane, and a number of people were killed. And it's always been, if you read St. John Hunt's, the Howard Hunt's son's book, Bond of Secrecy, he makes a very strong case that it was so important that Dorothy be killed to shut Howard Hunt up. Howard Hunt was going to be going to go to trial in January, and he had threatened to blow the whistle on what Watergate was all about. And Dorothy actually was a courier from some of the hush money, and so it was important to send a message to Howard Hunt that he had to be quiet. He had to shut up, which he did. He immediately called his... I went to the funeral of Dorothy. It was the most moving experience, one of the most moving experiences in my life. I arrived at the Catholic church there in Maryland, and Howard Hunt crossed the parking lot and embraced me. He was crying. He couldn't console Howard. He was crying, and then I started crying. And then the internment was a nearby cemetery, and it was something out of a novel or a book because there was lightning and thunder all around us. We were at the top of the hill as the casket was being lowered into the ground, but none of it hit us or anything like that. None of the rain hit us. It was just lightning and thunder all around. It was something unreal. But it convinced Howard Hunt enough. Her death convinced Howard enough that his children were. Could be targeted next, and that's why he pleaded guilty.
Wow. Now, you mention in this for your book being there, you talk about JFK's secret son, and who is that, or what's that about?
Well, I'm active on the education forum, the JFK assassination topic on the education forum, which... if you're interested in the JFK assassination, you can read whatever's put online. Usually a dozen things each day are put online by the members. Or if you really are a scholar in the Kennedy assassination, you can join the forum itself and put information on there that you have. But out of that came my knowledge of a great deal of this information about the alien presence and the Kennedy assassination. And what was the latter part of your question there?
About the JFK's secret son.
Oh, yeah. And out of that, I was contacted by Jack Worthington. His name is Jack Worthington, who had followed me for years on the education forum. And he asked me to represent him. He presented to me credible evidence that he was the secret son of JFK. He actually was from Houston, which is where I'm from at the present time. I've lived in Houston since 1979. And his family lived here. He grew up here. When he presented me this credible evidence, I said, well, I don't think I have the power to do what you want to do. We need an ally. And so I wrote a letter to Vanity Fair magazine, and Vanity Fair responded immediately saying they would like to meet me and Jack Worthington. And the meeting was set up in New York City at Vanity Fair's office. And the meeting did take place, but Jack Worthington did not go to the original meeting. Instead, he sent his trusted associate, who was Sharon Bush. Sharon Bush was the former wife of Neil Bush, of one of the sons of George H. W. Bush. And Jack Worthington knew her personally, and he asked her to be his personal representative. And as a result of this meeting at Vanity Fair, they wrote an article. They published an article about Jack Worthington, which anyone can read online. And it just puts Jack Worthington and Vanity Fair magazine, and the article will come up with pictures of Jack Worthington and so forth. I met Jack Worthington for the first time in the Harvard Club in New York City. When he crossed the lobby of the Harvard Club, chills went down my back because it felt like JFK was walking right towards me. It was such a close resemblance. But ultimately, Jack got cold feet on going forward and giving all the information he knew to Vanity Fair, because he felt he came to the belief that he would be assassinated, as had so many members of the Kennedy family. You know, it was Joe Kennedy Jr. who went down on a plane in World War II, and Jack Kennedy, and then Bobby Kennedy, and Jack Jr. Who went down in the plane crash off Massachusetts, you know, and an attempt was made on Ted Kennedy. And so he felt that if he went through this whole thing and actually proved that he was he was the son of JFK, that he would be targeted. And so he sort of withdrew from the whole, and this is sort of disclosed in the article in Vanity Fair magazine.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about yourself there. What do you think, what kind of impact did McCarthy have on you, like being part of that and working there at the beginning when you were young? Do you think it had some sort of influence?
No, I was reflecting the beliefs of my parents, who were very conservative, very Republican, and very anti-communist. Of course, everybody was anti-communist in those days. Bill yeah. McCarthy was a very popular figure. Even after his censure, he has become so controversial that nobody will speak up on his behalf today, even though there have been disclosures of major spies being uncovered both in the FBI and the CIA since then. It was really a passive. I mean, I did this while I was in high school, and then I immediately thereafter left to go to college. I went to the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, and so my whole interest or my whole life changed because I became a college student studying to be a diplomat. And so the Joe McCarthy episode was actually a minor element in my life, but it did serve to get me started in what I describe in my life. I went through so many events, historic events, all of which I just walked into, none of which I sought out.
Right.
Much like I described, I got this phone call from Howard Hunt from the White House office in the early hours of June 17, 1972, when he said he wanted to come to talk to me about something, and it turned out to be Watergate. That's sort of how my life has always been. Things just happen. And so I'm asked today what my future plans are, and I say I'm just a piece on a chessboard, and I just wait and see what happens.
What's your assessment now of all of the Russia involvement of late with the government, elections, Trump, all the different aspects? But there's been a lot of talk about Russia. And what's kind of your interpretation of that?
Well, I've actually given information both to FBI Director Comey before he was fired and to Special Counsel Mueller on the Russian connection to our election. And I did this in, and you can read this online on the Education Forum. I did this because I was contacted by a representative that I knew from the LaRouche organization in January of 2016, the presidential election in 2016. And he said, "Will you?" His name was Harley Schlanger. He said, "Will you put me in touch with Roger Stone?" And Roger Stone was very close and has been very close to Donald Trump. They both were proteges of Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn taught them what they know about politics. And so I agreed to do so. And then it turned out thereafter that the LaRouche organization, if you read that dossier that was prepared by that British intelligence officer, it disclosed at that famous dinner in December of 2015, where Putin was present and General Flynn was present. That was the dinner on behalf of Russia Today, the media outlet, that the LaRouche organization had a delegation there. And so it turned out, essentially, in my belief, that the LaRouche organization was given an assignment at that dinner at that meeting that went on there in Moscow to get close to Trump or to people around him. And so I put Harley Schlanger in touch with Roger Stone, and they became a team together. And I lay this out in a letter to all of this with the documents and emails and so forth to Special Counsel Mueller, and I say, essentially, it's up to you. I don't have the wherewithal to investigate this, but there is a section in the law called misnomer of felony. And what it is that if you have knowledge of a felony may be planned or has taken place, you have an obligation to call this to the attention of a court or to a law enforcement agency. And if you don't do so, you could be charged with being charged with a felony yourself for not disclosing this information. So I felt, as an attorney, I had an obligation to disclose this to Special Counsel Mueller. And we do know from the news accounts that Roger Stone is being heavily investigated by Mueller and may be in deep trouble. And we'll just have to wait and see whether any of the information I gave him will play a role in what comes down in that. I do believe it was a concerted attempt by Russia using Trump. Trump has been very close with Russia for many, many years, really going back, I think, to 1987. And I think that I don't think we had a fair election. I don't think our election was an honest election in 2016.
Yeah, it's a lot of people that agree with that. I'm surprised that the U.S. has been so anti-Russia and Soviet, and especially the conservatives, and it seems to be, as of late, they're a lot more open to Russia, more positive talking.
Well, I visited Russia in 1974 at the height of the Cold War, and I came back and proposed to Human Events, which was a conservative publication, that I write an article because of what I saw over there. Essentially, it was just the people were so poor, the poverty was so evident everywhere, and that. But the military was so strong, you know, but it still was like a Potemkin village. But when communism fell about 1991, the United States was stupid, or the people in Washington were stupid, and the way they handled this. And this was George H.W. Bush, I think he was president then, was he not? And instead of what they did with Japan after World War II, when General MacArthur was there, they reconstructed the society and made it a democracy. All we did was to go into Russia and try to steal their resources. I know this from people who were asked to do that. And so the emergence of Putin had to take place sooner or later, because we were stealing everything right and left from Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed. And Putin came in and rescued his country, and in some ways I can understand and sympathize with what he did to salvage what he did in Russia, and why he feels and the enmity that he has towards the United States, actually towards Hillary Clinton, because when he tried to, or when he ran again to be the head of the Soviet Union, we, our CIA, and through Hillary and so forth, made every effort to make sure that he would fail, but he did not. And so he got even by using Trump to rig our election. And Trump was more than willing to do so. I think Trump is heavily compromised, heavily blackmailed by Russia.
Yeah, he's certainly about the money and what he can get out of things. That's for sure. Certainly not the character of a president like Kennedy or something like that.
Yeah, but if we'd only handled it after the communism fell in 1991, if we only handled Russia differently, it would have been different. The whole world would be different. But it was these capitalists in the United States who are so greedy, they never can get enough money. They can never get enough power. And that's what happened. We went in there to really to rape Russia of its natural resources. And it could turn out, Russia today could be a vital, vibrant democracy, just like Japan became after World War II, but our stupid leaders led us astray, and now we're paying the penalty for that.
Yeah. And just one last thing before we go. The book just came out in May 25th. It's on Amazon, and I'd imagine most bookstores. It's called Being There, Eyewitness to History, and it's by Douglas Caddy. Do you have a website as well?
No, I do not, but I'm very active on Facebook, and if anyone would like to reach me, they can do so through Facebook.
Fantastic. I'm going to have your book linked on our website as well, so our listeners can just click and pick it up. And it's been a real honor having you on the show. I really appreciate all the things that you've done and putting out the book and passing on the information.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored to have been on the show. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.